We'll begin our first case.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Paul Gill. I'm with the Federal Public Defender. I represent Robert Hansen in this appeal from the denial of a suppression motion. The legal issue, the primary legal issue I'll be discussing today is whether the Virginia cigarette tax law applies to cigarettes bought outside Virginia in North Carolina by a Massachusetts resident passing through Virginia on the way back to Massachusetts. In discussing that issue, I want to start with the primary definition of what the tax is that Title 58.1-1001A imposes upon cigarettes. That definition is very simple. It says that everyone in the Commonwealth who sells cigarettes or stores or receives cigarettes for the purpose of distribution to any person within this Commonwealth shall pay an excise tax. Furthermore, 58.1-1000 defines the term storage to specifically exclude the keeping of cigarettes for subsequent use outside the Commonwealth of Virginia. So in addition, 58.1-1003 essentially states that the affixing of stamps is both the method and proof of the payment of that cigarette tax. So when we look to...
How does this work mechanically? Whose burden is it to get it, to get the cigarette stamped? And how do they go about doing that? Just tell me, walk me through it mechanically.
Well, Judge, there's an elaborate set of procedures in Virginia and in most states that have a cigarette tax that Virginia, for example, uses the term stamping agents. Essentially, stamping agents are maybe wholesalers or other people involved in the distribution of cigarettes that are responsible for seeing to it that cigarettes that are held for distribution within the Commonwealth get the stamps affixed to them.
The stamp means you've paid the tax.
That's correct. And they essentially purchase the stamps. And I think if I remember correctly, there are provisions for them to acquire them, as it were, on credit. But essentially, the stamping agents are responsible for the affixing of the stamps. But again, getting back to the seminal issue, I think, is whether under the circumstances presented to Trooper Murphy, who executed the traffic stop in this case, there was probable cause to believe the cigarettes he saw in Mr. Hansen's vehicle were subject to the tax. And that brings us to the record that was made in the district court as to what the facts were at the time Trooper Murphy commenced the search. I think several things are clear and undisputed from the record. First, the cigarettes he saw were not hidden. They were in plain view. They were in fact, clear plastic bag in the back seat of an SUV, the entire cabin of which, of course, was subject to the trooper's view. Mr. Hansen was, in fact, headed north on Interstate 95. I believe the record at Joint Appendix.
So when there's a stop here and no one disputes the validity of the traffic stop, you're not talking
no, Judge.
About that. I mean, because this car went over the rumble strip, as I understand it, and came a bit close to hitting a state trooper and the car that was the subject of another ticketing.
That was the testimony of Trooper Murphy, yes, sir.
So he didn't move into when he saw the state trooper giving out a traffic ticket, and he not only didn't move into the left lane, but he went at least into the rumble strip. And the maybe that somebody it's an odd thing for someone to do who might be carrying contraband to give the officer a close call. But be that as it may, the traffic stop is not disputed. So you got to stop. The officer sees the packs of cigarettes on the back seat, and to take your view of the statute, you have this quantity of cigarettes, which is larger than almost twice the amount which presumptive distribution is assumed. or is distribution is presumed. And the driver of the car says to the officer who conducts a traffic stop, these are not for distribution within the Commonwealth. I'm just passing through on the interstate, okay? Is the officer simply obliged to take the motorist's word for that? What does the officer do in a situation where someone represents to the officer, yes, I have these cigarettes, but I wanted to buy them in North Carolina because it was less expensive, but I have no interest in distributing them in Virginia. I'm going back to Massachusetts. Is the officer at that point obliged to take the motorist's word? I mean, what do you think transpired?
Judge, let me first, I will, of course, address that question. I do want to make clear, though, when you describe the presumption set forth in 58.1-1017D, which is presumably the presumption referred to, does not say that if you have at least three cartons of cigarettes, that creates a presumption that they are for distribution. What that provision says is that creates a presumption that
the presumption is one of tax evasion.
But again, that does not answer the question of whether, under the facts known to Trooper Murphy at the time, the tax applied at all. Now, back to your question, I think the answer is, of course, the trooper's not obliged to simply accept on blind faith a statement from any witness or any person he's pulled over, but in the totality of the evidence by the time he commenced the search, there was no suggestion to contradict, and in fact, he accepts that Mr. Hansen is from Massachusetts. He is, by the time the search commenced, he's established that Mr. Hansen is from Massachusetts. If one were to listen to, in fact, the audio and videotape of the stop that the district court did, you can hear clearly Mr. Hansen's Massachusetts accent. So he stopped a Massachusetts person with a Massachusetts driver's license in a Massachusetts vehicle heading north from North Carolina, where he says he's bought the cigarettes. In fact, when he first enters the car, Trooper Murphy does, and opens up the cigarette carton to see what all he really sees is, of course, there are no stamps on that, which he recognizes.
So your view is that the absence of stamps for a quantity of greater than 30 cigarettes does not provide, or 30 packages of unstamped cigarettes, that does not provide probable cause for any search of the car?
No, Judge, it does not. And the reason for that, again, is this. When one looks at those facts, all the record facts by the time Trooper Murphy starts the search are that these cigarettes were purchased outside of the state of Virginia and were headed to someplace other than the state of Virginia. And there is no suggestion of facts to support the application of the tax itself under the definition of the tax within 58.1-1000.
Well, could I ask how your analysis accounts for the officer's recitation of his training and experience? For instance, he indicated, although I'd never heard of such a thing, that Hansen's claim to be coming from Brunswick, Georgia, was somehow suspect, that the cigarettes were packaged in a way that is not usually found in that area, but more specifically, that he had received training on the Virginia tobacco tax stamp law that informed his view of the facts.
Well, two things, Judge. On his discussion of how the cigarettes were packaged, page 66 of the joint appendix reflects what he says is that the clear plastic bag the cigarette cartons were contained in within the back of the SUV is not consistent with how he has seen cigarettes packaged in Emporia, which is essentially the one spot between the North Carolina border and 13 miles north of it where Mr. Hansen was stopped, in which one can buy cigarettes off the highway in Virginia. So what he's essentially saying is, I agree that evidence suggested to me they were not purchased in Virginia. So again, that goes back to Judge Wilkinson's question. The record clearly established they were not bought in Virginia.
Well, to follow up on Judge Duncan's question, what I got from what the trooper said was that it was his belief that he had been trained that all cigarettes, virtually all cigarettes above this 30-pack or whatever it is limit, had to be stamped in Virginia, no matter where they come from. I mean, is his training, is his testimony about what the Virginia statute says consistent with what you believe it says?
No, it is not. And I don't, of course, the record doesn't really have a lengthy elaboration of what exactly the training was or in what setting or how often or whatever it was. He does make reference to the fact that I think his training, he said, was from a gentleman with Philip Morris. Now, again, if we go back to when we talk about the institutional production, manufacture, and distribution of cigarettes, it would make perfect sense for training about the general chain of distribution of cigarettes to say, for example, if you are in the business of selling cigarettes within the Commonwealth of Virginia, of course there are stamping requirements. Excuse me, there are tax requirements. But we have no indication that anyone said to pointed out to him in training, what does 58.1-1001A say?
Unfortunately, we also don't have any judicial interpretation of what the statute says either, do we?
That's correct.
So we don't have an officer acting contrary to established law.
Judge, it depends. If by that you mean, do we have an officer acting contrary to established on-point case law? Of course, the answer has to be no. But if that is the proposition, then of course, and that seems to be going down the line of the good faith argument that the government's making here. The problem that raises is what that means is every time you have a statute, and there are plenty of statutes in Virginia that have not been construed by appellate courts. In fact, many of them, I can't find recognition of construction by circuit courts or district courts. If the proposition is, well, because there's no on-point case law contradicting an officer's construction of the statute, then that should be excused and accepted from the exclusionary rule. That's a long distance away from where that rule
is. And where I was going with that is that the Supreme Court has said that an officer can rely on an interpretation of a law that is subsequently overruled. And it would seem somewhat anomalous to allow that, but not to allow a reliance on a statute that has yet to be interpreted that may or may not be wrong.
Judge, those are two very different items conceptually. When one is, I mean, in Wilkes and Davis, which are the decisions on that point, there is a certain intuitive sense to, and of course the line drawn there says, when an officer has on-point appellate case law, that's specifically what those cases stand for, on-point appellate case law that says action X is lawful, and then while that case is pending against that person, a new case comes out and overrules that and says action X is no longer lawful, then the exclusionary rule should not apply. That is a far cry from saying when there is a statute that has not been definitively or really in any manner construed by published opinions one way or the other.
The question then becomes whether the officer's interpretation in the absence of judicial construction is nonetheless a reasonable one. Now, is it possible to set up a framework in this fashion that, you know, we do have this presumption, and it's in a criminal statute, and it says when you have more than 30 packages of unstamped cigarettes, such possession shall be presumed to be for the purpose of evading the payment of the taxes due thereon, and that's in a criminal provision, 58.1-1017. Now, this is a presumption. It's not conclusive. Is it your position that, because we have to give some effect to the presumption here that the criminal law has been violated. Is it your view that the presumption was rebutted by the Massachusetts plates and the driver's explanation We've got to give, your position has to give some effect to the presumption. It's a provision of the criminal law. That's what police officers do. They enforce provisions of the criminal law. So we can't just let the presumption be of no effect.
Judge, 58.
Is it rebutted by the Massachusetts plates?
It's really not a matter of rebuttal. It's two points, Judge. First,
can I just ask you this? Because I had exactly the same problem, and I think that this is, a difficult statute to make this all come together. And is it your position you don't even get to the presumption part because you first have to go to the definition of what is to be taxed? Is that what you are?
Essentially, yes, Judge. And maybe it's just a rhetorical flourish how you put it, but 58.1-1017D, which, by the way, actually does not define a crime standing alone, and the provision, the subparagraph, subsection D, talks about a presumption in the context of a civil penalty. But even if one assumes that that can create a presumption for purposes of one prong of the offense described at 58.1-1017B, there is another seminal prong to that, and that is that the tax applies. Whether there's
so
some presumption
of whether the tax applies, we go to the 1001 provision?
Absolutely.
It's your submission that the cigarettes here, that just the presence of this number, although it might later down the road create this presumption, that he didn't have probable cause to think that the definition of the tax, of application of the tax applied. Is that right?
That's correct, Judge. And in fact, again, based on
the
record.
And the reason why he didn't have that is?
It's because all the information he had at the time he commenced the search was that the cigarettes were purchased outside of North Carolina and were not for the purpose of distribution within Virginia. There is no suggestion to the contrary. Every piece of evidence we had was that this person was on a road trip. He had gone from Massachusetts down south. He was heading back to Massachusetts. That's what the physical evidence was consistent with, the stop evidence was consistent with, the observations were consistent with.
Could I make sure I understand what you're saying? You're saying that unless the motorist presents some evidence to suggest to the contrary, doesn't have a Massachusetts accent, for example, that the presumption never comes into play?
Well, again, whether the presumption, whether one wants to say the presumption comes into play or it doesn't come into play, the presumption doesn't, under rules of statutory construction, you don't take that sub-provision, subsection D, and say, well, that allows us to essentially ignore the other provisions of the statute.
How is the officer supposed to figure all this stuff out? I mean, we're trying to parse this thing. We're thinking maybe we should certify it, and we've got these different, the question is whether something's a rebuttable presumption and whether it's a criminal provision because it doesn't have a penalty in and of itself, but yet it follows two provisions, two subsections providing for guilty of a class two misdemeanor. It looks how does a police officer by the side of the road who's received training on this stuff supposed to take this statute and parse it when the district court sort of supported the police officer's reading of it? And it's quite obvious from this argument that we're struggling a little bit with it and what the strength of the presumption is and whether it's criminal or civil and whether it can be rebutted. How's somebody supposed to figure that out in the 20 minutes of a traffic stop?
Judge, it's not figuring it out in the 20 minutes of the traffic stop. It is an officer, of course, has an obligation to know what the law is. 58.1.
Well, we don't know what it is.
Judge, respectfully, 58.1-1001A is unambiguous.
No, but isn't it enough that the officer makes an objectively reasonable determination of an unsettled question of state law? I mean, the ultimate touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness and as long as it's an objectively reasonable interpretation, and it was an interpretation that the district court bought, and it certainly has some grounding in the language of the statute, how can you penalize the officer or apply the exclusionary rule in those sorts of situations where it seems to me this is the analogy in law to what United States versus Leon was with respect to facts and warrants. It's not exactly the Leon case, but is it parallel?
Just piggybacking on that, if you could explain, given the ambiguity, what deterrence value would be served by exclusion?
Judge, let me, in combination, try and address those questions. That's unclear to me how much time I have, but I'll try my best to address them. First, with respect to the concept of whether a mistake of law is reasonable or not, again, I go back to 1001A. On the record presented by the time the search commenced, 1001A is not triggered by the evidence before Trooper Murphy, and therefore it's not a reasonable mistake of law. Second, of course, this court...
And we have some precedent on that.
I'm sorry?
So do other courts. It's saying a mistake of law doesn't get you
That's
home.
Correct, and I've recited a lot of that case law in my briefing and obviously stand by that. This court has certainly not gone to a different direction at this point, and in fact, in some unpublished decisions, has assumed that that remains the law. With respect to Leon is a very different situation because what Leon says is that in the circumstances when an officer acts in reasonable reliance upon a warrant which is legitimate on its face and issued by a judge that has found probable cause after a review of things, that the exclusionary rule does not apply. That obviously is not the situation here at all. With respect to the deterrence value, one of the things that the courts that have talked about both reasonable mistake of law, whether standing alone or in conjunction with good faith principles, point out is that if we go in the direction of saying, well, there's no on-point case law in a facially possibly ambiguous statute, therefore the stop is legitimate, it allows officers essentially to be less vigilant about how they understand the law and reading the law and understanding
the
law.
Well, assume for just a moment that we accept your argument that we can't rely on a mistake of law. What about a mistake of fact here?
Judge, I'm not sure I discern a
reasonable
mistake of fact.
Well, the officer believed that the cigarettes were purchased in Virginia. He didn't have to believe your man, right? Found in Virginia, and there weren't any labels on them.
Judge, returning back to the record, especially pages 70 and 71 of the joint appendix, what's clear is, he accepts Mr. Hansen's statement that the cigarettes were purchased in North Carolina. B, he recognizes they are not packaged the way.
Which state puts the labels on?
No, actually, North Carolina, page 71 of the Joint Appendix, Trooper Murphy correctly recounts that North Carolina does not affix tax stamps. North Carolina has its own tax. It is, in fact...
So he says, Mr. Murphy says to the officer, I purchased these in North Carolina. The officer doesn't have to believe him. The officer looks at the things and sees they're not stamped. They're not stamped. They would have to be required to be stamped under Virginia law if they were purchased in Virginia. Now, I understand there are these facts that he speaks with the Massachusetts accent, which I love, but which is unusual around here. And he has a Massachusetts license and so forth.
You should meet my paralegal, Judge.
But I'm not sure there's not enough basis for a mistake of fact.
Judge, I guess I'd answer that two ways. First, there is no suggestion from either the district court opinion or Trooper Murphy's testimony that he, in fact, made a mistake in...
Well, but that we have the actions of Trooper Murphy. He doesn't accept the man's statement that they were bought in North Carolina. He goes and looks at them to see if they, you know, which
true.
Indicates that... Okay. I think you have maybe... We have some more questions, or you have some time left to rebut.
And I think my time's long over.
It
I'm
is.
I'm happy to answer whatever questions the court has.
You have some rebuttal time.
I do.
We need to hear from Mr.
Thank
Cook.
You.
May it please the court, Richard Cook on behalf of the United States. The district court correctly concluded that Trooper Murphy had probable cause that the defendant was transporting or possessing untaxed cigarettes in violation of Virginia law. A critical step in the defendant's argument in interpreting the statutory scheme here is his contention that 58.1-1001A defines essentially the universe as of who is covered by this tax. And he points specifically to the language in 1001 that requires that the person selling, storing, or receiving the verbs in that statute have the cigarettes, quote, for the purpose of distribution to any person within this commonwealth. He says, well, look, the defendant claims he was taking them to Massachusetts, so they're not for the purpose of distribution in the commonwealth. Therefore, he's not covered by the statute. The problem with that interpretation is there are a number of problems with it. The first is that it would mean that the statute never reaches anyone who is going to possess untaxed cigarettes in the state of Virginia for consumption or distribution in the state of Virginia.
Well, the statute says who sells, stores, or receives cigarettes made of tobacco or any substitute thereof for the purpose of distribution to any person within the Commonwealth. So he's selling, storing, or receiving.
Right.
And he can be distributing to himself, his friends.
Right. The point I'm driving at is that it's clear that Virginia law does cover somebody, a consumer, for example, who has a large quantity of untaxed cigarettes and is transporting them around in Virginia. And that's covered by 58.1-1017. It's also made clear by the tax form, the TT7 form that the Virginia state government uses that would have no meaning on the defendant's reading of the law. And the defendant's reading of law for 1001, somebody who had cigarettes in Virginia for personal consumption would never qualify as a person who was selling, storing, or receiving cigarettes for the purposes of distribution to another person within the Commonwealth. The consumer who had untaxed cigarettes in the state simply would never be covered by 1001, but the state obviously disagrees with that.
Well, I don't understand. Wouldn't that person be receiving cigarettes?
Not for the purpose of distribution to a person within the Commonwealth.
So, let me understand what you're saying. You're saying that anybody that... What are you saying?
I'm saying that if you receive untaxed cigarettes in the state of Virginia, you owe the tax. And that's the point of the...
Even if you get one pack of cigarettes, you owe that tax.
Right. Now... That doesn't mean that you've violated the criminal law, to be clear. The criminal law, which is...
Well, but then you're receiving. You are within this statute.
But I don't think a person who receives cigarettes for their own personal consumption is receiving them for the purpose of distributing to another person within the Commonwealth. So that's why I think 1001 does not define the universe. But the key point is that 1017 has plain language that does reach the situation.
Your overall point is that one doesn't stop at the definitional section, that the presumption is necessarily a part of the interpretation of the statute as a whole?
That's right. And that really what you see in this statutory scheme is a series of sections that are reaching different situations. And 1001 is addressing the situation of people who are in the business of distributing, basically. 1017 is a statute that deals essentially with people who are moving around untaxed cigarettes, which are can be viewed as a type of contraband.
Regardless of whether they're for distribution or not.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Regardless of whether they're for distribution or not.
Exactly. The 1017A starts off, any person except as otherwise provided by law who sells, purchases, transports, receives, or possesses unstamped cigarettes shall be required.
Okay, so you're saying that the purposive provision, that language for the purpose of distribution, which is in 58.1.1001, does not apply to the 58.1.17, that they address very different problems, that one addresses possession with purpose of distribution, and the other simply addresses moving within the Commonwealth certain quantities of unstamped cigarettes.
Right. And in fact, 1017...
So they're aimed at very different situations?
Exactly. And 1017 includes a whole series of verbs that, if it was limited by 1001, would be surplusage. So most notably here, you have the verb transport, which isn't listed in 1001.
Is it important to your position that 58.1.7 does not refer to 58.1.001?
I think that's a helpful fact. But another important point here.
Well, what do you make of the except as otherwise provided by law in 1017? Because you could think that that means that it's just, it's to be read with 1001.
It's to be read with 1001 and other provisions. There are people who are legitimately in the business of distributing cigarettes who, under certain circumstances, can move around untaxed cigarettes, and the statutes provide for that. And that would be a situation where you wouldn't be in violation of 1017 because you're in the business of distributing cigarettes and you're in a situation where you can move them without violating the law. But
it's not an option for us to have this question certified, is it? Because it's not controlling. It's not dispositive.
I would agree with that. And I think that generally it would be a bad thing in the context of suppression motions to certify, because certification...
Well, part of your response would be the fact that we are contemplating certification suggests a lack of clarity.
That's right. I agree with that.
I don't know of a question... I don't know of a question of state law that's ever been certified in the context of a federal suppression hearing.
Suppress.
It would might be a first. So one of the things that I'm always concerned about is how we translate these arguments in a courtroom to officers who are on the street, and what kind of guidance and what kind of standards we use. And we've had a very interesting discussion about whether 5817 and 5801 apply to certain situations, and we've had a very interesting discussion about differences between mistakes of fact and mistakes of law. I try to look at it from the standpoint of the officer who is conducting the traffic stop, and the Supreme Court makes the point that the ultimate touchstone of all Fourth Amendment interpretation is the standard of objective reasonableness, no matter what. That just cuts across everything. So regardless of whether the officer made a correct judgment of law or didn't on a very close question. Is it enough in terms of the deterrent purposes of the Fourth Amendment and in terms of the overall standard of objective reasonableness that he acted on the basis of this presumption in 17 subsection D, and that that provided an objectively reasonable foundation for his actions? I mean, is there a more straightforward way to get at this without parsing everything, as long as you can say, look, you have this presumption under Virginia law, it's arguably a criminal statute, and there's no question that there was double the amount that was presumed to be for tax evasion, and that's a reasonable foundation in law for an officer to act. I mean, I'm just throwing this out. Is that a sound approach to this case?
I think it is, and there's really two ways that one can come at that question. One is the good faith argument that we've made about the exclusionary rule, where you would conclude even if there's a Fourth Amendment violation here because the officer got the state law wrong, the exclusionary rule shouldn't apply. But there's another even simpler, narrower approach, which is that the presumption that is embodied in 58.1.10.17, and that's repeated, I should note, in the administrative code, there's an analogous provision to 10.17, which is 23 Virginia Administrative Code 10.370.180. The variety of numbers here makes it hard to follow. But the key point is that the presumption that's in both the administrative code and in the statute refers to that the presumption shall be, or that the possession of more than 30 packages or 3 cartons of unstamped cigarettes shall be presumed to be for the purpose of evading the payment of the taxes due thereon. That presumption encompasses the ultimate illegality of the cigarette possession. So if the defendant were right that this is a statute that deals only, the whole scheme deals only with people who are distributing cigarettes, and that possession for consumption isn't even covered, it would still be the case that this is a presumption that says if you've got more than 3 cartons, you're presumed to be possessing them for the purpose of evading the taxes. And so you'd have built into the presumption the very narrow reading of the statute that the defendant has.
So your interpretation doesn't require us to tackle the subject on which we do have precedent with respect to the unreasonable, not being able to rely on a mistake of law.
On this, yeah, that's right. I think if I follow that, if you looked at this presumption as encompassing a narrow reading of the Virginia state law that says, okay, this state law only addresses distribution, the wording of this presumption means that the officer is entitled to conclude that the possession of the cigarettes was for that narrow purpose, because it says it shall be presumed to be for the purpose of evading the payment of the taxes due thereon. And as we noted in our brief, if an officer confronts somebody where the elements of the offense are met and there's a possible defense, at the probable cause stage, an officer isn't required to take the defendant's word on a defense. For example, suppose a police officer encounters somebody with 30 oxycodone pills, and the person cannot produce the prescription. There's nothing in the packaging of the drugs that makes it clear that the drugs go with the person. The officer wouldn't necessarily have to take the person's word that the 30 oxycodone pills were theirs, even if the person said, oh, yeah, I've got a prescription, it's at home. But
so
you can't look at
it. Would it ever count toward probable cause if the person was found with the 20 packages of cigarettes? They were unstamped. That's still, you know, a good number of cigarettes. But that would be okay, because that would not weigh in the probable cause calculus. And I think we would all agree that without those cigarettes, there was no probable cause for this search. You can't just point to somebody's nervousness and air fresheners and say you've got a right to go in the car. That's you need those cigarettes.
That's absolutely true. The cigarettes, and really to be clear, I think it's important to note that the search here can really be divided into two parts. There's first the, was he entitled to get in the car and look at the cigarettes? And then there's the later search that leads to the discovery of the drugs. And there's different probable cause going into each. But as the case comes to this court and as it was litigated essentially at the suppression hearing, the case was boiled down to, okay, was there probable cause to look for the, at the cigarettes in the car? And then it's agreed that once you once you were allowed to do that and you discovered the 5,500
cash. Is it undisputed that he was able just by looking in the window, was able to discern that these were 60 packages or quantity greater than 30?
Yes, as I read the record, the officer's testimony that was credited by the district judge is that he was able to see that it was at least six cartons of cigarettes.
So without ever going into the car, he was able to see that there were the six cartons.
Right. And
can I ask you, is it your position that under Virginia law, cigarettes always, every cigarette has to be, every pack of cigarettes has to be stamped? Is there ever a situation when you doesn't have to be?
I think there are. For example, if you were in the business of transporting, you're a commercial distributor, wholesaler of cigarettes, and you're taking them to an outlet, for example, there could be circumstances where the law would permit you to.
And what do you get that from?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, one moment. No, I wrote this down.
Is that from 1001?
It's not, although I think here's one provision that you could look at. It would be 58.1-1010, which addresses when a wholesaler can ship cigarettes without stamps.
But that you wouldn't think that 1001 says that you can have cigarettes in Virginia provided that they're not sold, stored, or received for the purposes of distribution to any person. Otherwise, it's legal in Virginia to not have stamped. I mean, that's what the language seems to say, right?
I agree with that. I think, again, though, 1001 is dealing with those who are.
It says tax levied, except, and it says these are the provisions for when the tax is levied. When a person who sells, stores, or receives cigarettes made of tobacco, the purpose of distribution to any person within the state, then you pay the tax.
Right. And then.
And it doesn't say there are other times when you pay the tax.
I think it's critical that the. A starts off, except as provided in subsection B,
right,
which is not the important part.
To be sure.
Mm-hmm.
And but are you says, relying on something on subsection B?
No.
No.
And I think that the scheme does, I mean, the provisions are read together. 1001 doesn't stand alone as the sole statute in this.
Well, it's the first, and it's okay.
Well, there's the definition section.
It's defined in the code, tax levied, and it tells you taxes are levied in these occasions.
That's true, but again, that's not the way the Virginia Department of Taxation doesn't read 1001 as being the sole provision governing tax. Otherwise, there would be, as I started, no tax on consumers ever, which would be inconsistent with the language of the other statutory provisions and inconsistent with the fact of the TT7 form, which is asking a consumer to pay taxes.
He could have been traveling through Virginia or having within Virginia a whole trunkload of cigarettes, and his back seat could have been crammed full of them, and happened. They could have been spilling out of the car. And, you know, as long as there was an argument, well, I'm going to Massachusetts, Virginia could do nothing about it if the appellant's interpretation was correct. Is that right.
And
that's the result.
But the very amount of them there suggests that there's distribution. I mean, just in and of itself.
That's right.
Distribution to another person, because not too many, no matter how smoke hounds we are, nobody is smoking that many.
That's right. And I think it's...
So that you would still come within 1001 in that respect.
I agree. And I think it is critical to point out a practical point here, which is, of course, there are big differences in taxes on cigarettes between and among states. And it is a profitable enterprise to take them from low-tax places to high-tax places. And it would be surprising if you had a statutory scheme that allowed people to move around with, you know, what you could refer to as undocumented cigarettes, large quantities that show no sign of payment of tax, and take them through, and that wouldn't be something that the state would have the ability to stop. I see that my red light is on.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
I'm fine. Thank you.
Ask that the court affirm the district court.
Mr. Gill, we'd like to hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Judges, there was a comment about, I think it was Judge Duncan, you said, isn't your point you don't stop at the definition of 58.1-1001A? Of course, one doesn't stop at that. The flip side of that is one cannot stop at the presumption, which is what the government is fixated on here within 58.1-1017D.
Okay. Can you tell me how you read them together in real simple terms?
Well, in real simple
terms,
there
is such a thing.
Sure. Statutory construction rules say you read statutes on the same subject together and give meaning to all the terms.
Right.
58.1-1017, when it refers to taxes, there's no reason to think it doesn't refer back to 58.1-1001A, which defines what the tax is and on whom or where the tax applies.
So I think I've got that your position is that 1001 is the definitional. That tells you...
Yes, Judge. And then
what does the other thing do?
Subsection D does, at most, what it does if it is deemed even applicable to the separate subsection within 1017 defining a criminal offense. It creates a presumption as to one element of that criminal offense. The other element of that criminal offense in subsection B of 1017 is that that the cigarettes are not stamped as required by law.
Is that the only way to read it, though, that it is that narrowly applicable?
Yes, Judge. There's 58, subsection B of 58.1-1017 cannot be read to exclude words it actually uses within its elements. It describes the elements of the offense.
My problem is the practical one, that if your reading of that is correct, then Virginia has enacted a tax law that would allow someone to hire a large Allied van and put hundreds of cartons of cigarettes in it and travel all around Virginia. And would they be immune from any kind of search of the van if they just were clever enough to put license plates on it and of another state and travel on an interstate, and they say, oh, look, we're traveling on an interstate, and an interstate, by definition, means you're going from one state to another, and look at these plates. We don't even have a Virginia plate, and look at my driver's license. It's an Ohio driver's license, and can Virginia really have enacted a scheme that allows people to transport gigantic quantities of untaxed cigarettes all within the Commonwealth on the idea that it doesn't meet the definition of 01, which is for the purpose of distribution to any person within the Commonwealth? I mean, how far does your position extend?
Judge, first of all, there are provisions within Title 58.1 that would certainly allow, if it's evident from the circumstances of the stop, that the person is a wholesale dealer or meets certain definitions that Mr. Hansen does not meet, then there may be record-keeping requirements, there may be other requirements, there may be other reasons.
But why isn't the Commonwealth entitled to set a quantity, for a presumption? And we've been struggling with the interrelationship of 01 and 17, but why isn't subsection D of 1017, why isn't that self-sufficient? Why does it necessarily need to be read in pari materia, or does it say shall be presumed to be for the purpose of evading the payment of the taxes due thereon, which is in itself a statement of illegality? Tax evasion is an illegal act, and well, so it's not clear to me why that presumption isn't part of a self-contained provision.
Judge, again,
establishing an illegality all by its lonesome.
Judge, again, first of all, it does not describe an offense. It doesn't say this constitutes a misdemeanor like subsection B does. Second of all, again, subsection D is self-contained. The only reference to any penalty therein is to a civil penalty. So, again, there's no suggestion that subsection D trumps subsection B and somehow eliminates one of the elements of the offense described at subsection B.
Well, but subsection B talks about, I grant you, there's that language required by law, but it does say for the purpose of evading the payment of taxes shall be guilty of a Class 2 misdemeanor. So you get the idea reading subsection B that there's a criminal penalty attached to the act of evading the payment of the taxes. Now you've got that word required by law, but that's a little bit oblique. And the language purpose of evading the payment of taxes on such products shall be guilty of a Class 2 misdemeanor. And then I would read subsection B in pari materia with subsection D, because that describes what evading the payment of taxes is, and said, okay, you're presumed when you have more than 30 packages of unstamped cigarettes to meet that subsection B element, and that is part of a criminal provision. You do read, whatever else we read in pari materia, I would think we would read subsection B and subsection D in pari materia.
Judge, I don't think I dispute that. I just, when one looks at the language of the elements of the misdemeanor offense defined at 58.1-1017B, there is nothing oblique about the language of one of those elements, which is that the cigarette packs have not been, quote, stamped in the manner required by law, end quote. That, by definition, refers back to, it can't be some abstract idea. It's got to go back to what are the provisions of 58.1 that describe what cigarette packs need a stamp on it. And that leads us back to 58.1-1001. And, Judge, one last point I want to make with respect to the consumer tax and the form thereon, two points. As I pointed out in the brief, the form and the instructions thereof, which are available on the internet and I cited to in the briefing, what it clearly says is that consumers should be aware that all cigarette packs should have the Virginia stamp affixed regardless of where in Virginia the cigarettes were purchased. So that's referring to purchases in Virginia. There's another reference to typically but not always Virginia consumers come into possession of unstamped cigarettes through internet purchases, etc. So the Virginia Department of Taxation instructions and that Virginia consumer cigarette tax return that the government relies upon treat Virginia stamps as limited to cigarettes bought by Virginia consumers within Virginia or bought for consumption here from the internet or other out-of-state providers. Again, that's not the case here. And indeed, 58.1-10...
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up because we both here and earlier we've let you go over.
All right. Thank you, judges. Again, for all the reasons I've stated today and in the briefs, I'd ask that the court reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel. You want to proceed?
I'm fine.
Okay. We'll move right into our next case.